Why so serious?
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play dude.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the toy department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
Toy department time, boys and girls. I'm Derek Madden. He's Matt Kolsky. How are you today, sir?
I am hanging in there, cruising along.
Surviving?
Getting by.
You know, there's always a lot of stuff to talk about. But I think at this point, Game of Thrones has just elbowed its way to the number one spot in this podcast. We're probably going to open the next several pods, I would think, with... our thoughts on Thrones.
Got to.
I almost wish we were doing a Monday podcast now. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Not I hear that you. Either one of us has time for it. It's too many thoughts out there in the world on this show. But I got mine. But I want to start with you. How did you...
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Where were... Because we haven't talked at all, really.
Nope.
About the Battle of Winterfell.
Yeah.
Did it deliver for you, I guess, would be where I could start with that.
Yeah, and I think that's the right question, and the answer is a resounding yes. Now, that does not mean I don't see some flaws in the strategy, not of the episode, but of the combat, that I don't see some...
There are some major flaws in the military strategy.
Yeah, and maybe that'll be later explained, or maybe it's just about making the visually most explosive and interesting thing they could. And the one criticism I've heard a lot of that I definitely don't agree with is the whole, oh, it was so dark, I couldn't see anything. Like, I thought they effectively used the way they shot it and the lighting to create a feeling and a mood, and I thought it worked, and I thought it looked incredible, and I thought the dragon scenes were awesome, and I really enjoyed myself. I was on the edge of my seat virtually the entire time. I thought they really effectively used sound dynamics, you know, like the quiet versus the cacophony of battle. I thought the scene with the torches all getting extinguished was awesome. I thought this was what it was supposed to be. $100 million battle scene that was a blast.
Yeah, I don't know that I totally get the it was dark criticism. I feel like, did you watch the Battle of Blackwater? You know
it's
what I
dark.
Mean? Like that's...
Yeah.
It, we're talking about night fighting. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So like...
Although that is one of the strategic concerns I have, that if you are the initiators, why not wait?
I mean...
Am I wrong?
I would say, yeah, they were the initiators nominally, in the, if you want to say, like, who charged first.
Uh-huh.
But, like... I don't think if they had just stood there, the fight was coming to them. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think it would have been like, oh, well, we would have started tomorrow morning.
They could have put some fires on and just put them out there so they could see the battlefield as well as possible and then let the crazy dead people come to them instead of rushing headlong into darkness.
I mean, just the whole rushing headlong into darkness thing, or really the idea of, you know, we are going to... You know, we're clearly limited with men and resources.
Right.
We're
going to, like, toss some out there as an opening salvo.
Yeah, like, why would we put all of these really good fighting men in an infantry line at the front, like, knowing that they are almost certain to be savaged, right? Like, wouldn't
right.
the Dothraki
I mean,
be more valuable shooting arrows from somewhere on high?
Well, they're not really arrow guys. They fight with those Araks, the curved swords. So I get them being on the ground.
I mean, they have some they definitely have some arrow dudes. I've seen them in battle
maybe
before.
A couple, but mostly it's swords. Mostly it's cavalry, essentially. And I think, you know, part of the problem is Like, you've got a small staff of mostly pretty good fighting men. Whoever, like, everyone's going to get savaged at some point, in all likelihood.
Yeah, so, well, there was clearly a lot of savaging.
The order only matters so much, I suppose. But I mean, there are some other things, too.
It's like, why would you... So, building a trench of fire, clearly a smart idea.
Uh-huh.
Why would you then put that trench behind your men when they were clearly going to need to escape backwards at some point? Wouldn't you want that trench to be in front of you in the first place
and lit from the start? Yeah, that's sort of what I was saying. Yeah, like I said, I would have attacked differently, but to be fair, I have the benefit of years of military history that they had not yet seen.
That's right. I just think, you know, we're talking about, this is a collection of the greatest military minds of this world, winner of several battles, right, between them.
But it's all relative, man.
Could have been a better plan. There didn't really seem to be much of a plan at all for being beyond the dragons and stuff. Also, lead with your dragons, I feel like. Really,
I feel like both sides, there were issues on both sides, Derek, and I feel like one of those issues that was on both sides was oddly sparing use of the dragons, which generally makes me believe that that's just about the cost of the dragons.
Yes. All right. But, you know, since we're here, I didn't really want to do this first, but how can you not? We need to talk about the Night King's guard. You know what I mean? Like I don't know if they're his generals. But you know who I'm talking about, right? Like the 8 long-haired ice dudes.
I heard them. Someone was like, you know, those group of dudes that sort of looks like the Doobie Brothers.
Yeah.
That's them.
I mean, if we're now stepping back, because I feel like we can say succinctly that their arc on the show has been completed.
Mm-hmm.
What the F were those guys ever for? What did they do exactly?
I mean, I think they probably killed an awful lot of people
over
the years.
I think we saw one of them fight Jon Snow at one point, right?
We saw one of them. They're the guys who went and picked up babies from various places.
Yeah. But here's what I'm saying is there were roughly eight of those dudes standing around the Night King.
Well, but they weren't
in the climactic scene.
Yeah, no, I'm not into this criticism either. The Night King, like, stopped them and hubristically wandered up to Bran, thinking, I've got this thing
right. They were standing right behind him, is what I'm saying.
They were, like, 20 feet behind him, and Arya came sprinting out of the darkness. They weren't prepared for that. And you're looking at, like, you know, that's the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Like, they're not... We've seen these guys
wielding weapons. Like, they're not, this is not, we're not talking about Colin Powell up there. Like, these.
No, I think we are.
These Colin are dudes Powell, that can throw down.
Dude, Colin Powell has a gun. You know what I mean? Colin Powell wears a uniform. Yeah, but he's not a, it's not that he was a soldier at one point in his life. It's just he's not there to be a bodyguard. I'm not sure they're there to be a bodyguard as a leadership council.
I think they're like the most fearsome fighters. So it was the way that the show had sort of put them together. All of this to me is a little bit shorthand for the ending of the Night King to me, while thrilling and a great moment, felt a little Star Wars Death Star-y. You know what I mean? Where it's like Impossible Fighting Force has one fairly simple fatal flaw that was just going to get exposed.
I don't know that there was a fatal flaw so much as just an act of hubris.
Yeah, I mean, look, no, the Night King himself is essentially the... little thing at the end, the little target at the end that you have to hit to explode the Death Star. And if you can hit him.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Everything blows up, right? So.
But that was always I think we kind of knew that going in. To the extent that there was a plan, that was it.
You know, this whole show has been built up as it's the Great War, it's the existential threat of 1,000 lifetimes, right? And it's basically like, well, you got stabbed by a 17-year-old. A highly skilled 17-year-old, but a 17-year-old nonetheless. 17-year-old girl, nonetheless. So...
Well, first of all, I didn't appreciate the tone of the your sexist comment there.
It seems like a little bit of a shortcut is all I'm saying. That's all I'm saying.
I guess, but then now you're in the category of the people who I have to say, like, what did you want and or expect? Like, this world is filled with 17-year-olds in improbable circumstances.
Yeah. Well, it's almost exactly what I expected. I'm not saying that it ruined my enjoyment of the show.
Okay, so that's all it is to me, is yes, this show is much more predictable today than it was in its first three seasons. Unfortunately, that's the nature of entertainment, television, and storytelling, is as we head towards the finish line, we are often more predictable.
Yeah,
that is a universal truth.
They have to land the plane, 100%.
That's right.
I get that. And
they can't just land it upside down. It's not a thing. That doesn't happen.
To me, it sort of begs this question. I mean, right. Look, it's obvious they had to win this battle somehow, right? Like, otherwise, what are we doing for the last three episodes, right? So,
right. Like, there's a like I always say with these things, yes, there is a version of this story where that episode ends with the Night King winning. And it's a version we don't bother telling because it's dumb and it has a stupid ending.
So, of
the infinity multiverse universes, we focus on the universe where all the improbable stuff happens to lead us to an end point. That's how storytelling works.
I mean, look, I agree with you on that point, but I would say, you know, from a counter argument standpoint, at the end of the day, right, they're fighting the Great War, the war that, you know, literally they had to assemble the entire world to fight, and pretty light on major casualties at the end of this, right? There is a medium somewhere where there was maybe a greater cost of fighting this battle in terms of major players eliminated. And so, I'm curious, because this is the question I was sort of wondering. It's like, does it make it predictable in that, you know, no one, you know, there's this giant battle and no one really gets hurt? We lost a couple of guys, but no one really gets hurt. Or is it unpredictable because the show hinted at so many people dying last week and many of them did not die, right?
That's exactly my counterpoint. This is the thing. Don't tell me, oh, this show never shocks me anymore, when you told me last week how 35 different main characters were going
to
die.
I would have bet a large sum of money on Grey Worm not being in episode 4. And
that's right.
He made it. What people, you know what I mean?
What people are really saying is, how come they didn't murder more of the central characters? And like,
yes. That's a fair question, though.
Because, no, it's not. Why is that anything? Other than it being the thing that put this show on the map in season 1. Why does that – in what world has murdering main characters become a key aspect of storytelling or of making Game of Thrones good? I just don't get it.
Well, I do think it is part of the phenomenon, the idea –
part of what made it –
yeah,
but like,
that anybody could
go.
Is
that really why we're watching this?
But to me, that's not – no, but to me, that's not the issue. To me, it makes the threat of the Night King less credible when everyone – I mean, obviously not everyone. We lost. Poor one out for Lyanna Mormont. They gave her a just due. But
how about this?
But when you don't really lose anyone, like, was it really that great of a threat? Like, that to me is where the cost is. It's not so much like,
was it really that great of a threat? Are you serious?
Yeah, if everyone important survived. Everyone, pretty much, right? We lost Jorah. We lost Lyanna. Tough day for the Mormonts.
We lost a high percentage of the important characters on the front lines. Grey Worm made it, but he also is like the general. So
Brienne, Jamie, yeah, anybody you care about that was on the front lines made it, pretty much. The Hound.
Again,
Tormund.
No one's disputing that the death count was lower than expected.
Yeah.
I don't understand why that is being portrayed as a failure or a stunning disappointment.
Well, I feel like I just explained it. It's like, you know, this was the thing that was going to end all mankind, and couldn't take out any of the key people.
Hundreds of thousands of men appear to have died, or at least thousands, and you're mad that they're not the right men?
I'm not mad. I'm just asking
that's
questions,
what I'm saying.
Dude.
Not you, but you, the people who are mad at this. Like, that's the concern? That the wrong people died? Because you want to see more of your favorite people die? I truly don't understand the criticism.
I think the criticism is, right, the thing about the idea of anyone can die, right, at any time, and the show's willing to take out heroes, is that it kind of it just heightens the stakes, right? Because
and were the stakes not heightened?
In a world, where people don't die, then you're not very worried about them, right?
So let me ask you this. Were you worried about the characters throughout the episode? Do you believe this is now a world where people don't die?
No, right, because of the work that the show did previously. But I think for some people, the fact that people didn't die feels like that maybe undoes that going forward, and that's why they're upset. Explain why people might be mad about it, that's where that feeling comes from.
I think you just made my point that this is a very stupid criticism, that these are people who essentially are angry that in this one episode the wrong people died, that they think it might be a sign that the wrong people might die in the next three episodes. Like, that is going so – that's bending over so idiotically backwards to be upset at a tremendous episode of television.
I don't think it's that the wrong people might die in the next three. I think it's that people feel like no one important is going to die anymore. Like, they feel like that part of it's over.
All right. So then let's have that conversation in three episodes.
So, yeah. No, that's fine. It's weird that I'm now representing people who I don't feel that way. But
I know you don't. And if the show ends without any more major deaths, which would shock me, then maybe there's a conversation to be had about, boy, things got easy at the end.
Look, I don't think the show's going to end without many major deaths, but I don't think there are many major deaths left.
But what does that
mean?
One
or two. I forgot Melisandre, I guess, died, right? But that was a little bit of a cell phone there.
Yeah, I think she was gonna die anyway, and if she didn't, Davos was gonna take her down.
Right, he was ready. I think she was gonna die anyway because she told us she was gonna die anyway.
Right, and that's, but that's still a major character going down. The whole House of Mormon, Ed. You're right. It was not what we thought. But in a way, I think that's a way this show could surprise people still, is by not having that many major deaths. And, you know, again, let's see what happens in the next few episodes. There's still a war to fight, theoretically.
Yeah. Yes, like, there is. I don't think it's going to be very theoretical for very long.
But if they go to King's Landing and Cersei's like, you know what, guys? Good job. Let's just divvy this kingdom up and call it a day. Then, yeah, that'll suck. But I don't think that's what we're going to get.
No, it's not going to happen. I do think we are going to get another throat-clearing episode this week, though.
Yes. I don't know. I feel like I've had this debate with a paper tiger over and over again.
That almost has to happen, though, right?
Like, throat-clearing is storytelling. Yeah. We're now calling storytelling throat-clearing. the rubric for – if this show can't win, because what people have now come to expect is – every episode is both the most incredible, surprising tale of heroes and grandeur, and also the most impressive battle scene with the best possible strategy where important people die, but also the right people survive so we can continue to have the best story ever. It's just you can't do what – it's not literally possible to do what people expect this show to do on a week-to-week basis right now.
I agree. The bar is high. I would also say the bar is high is understating it, really, at this point. The bar is as high as you can put it. But I would also say the show is still winning, right? Like, it's winning, you know? Yes. I think everyone, like, people grumble, but everyone's pretty happy. And they're more, like, even, you didn't think it was possible, but literally more people are watching every week. So
I am not someone who really likes to point to, like, entertainment trends as statements on where our society is headed, but I really do think that some of the negativity about Game of Thrones is a sure sign of social decay.
That's probably true. And also like, some of the way we interact with each other, you know.
Yes, the way we interact is by criticizing things. That's just like who we are now. And like a lot of things deserve criticism, but sometimes not.
At the end of the day, there are just so few pieces of entertainment that can grip you the way that episode did. Were you like, you had that kind of knot in your stomach, right? Like,
yes.
And even though there were, you know, even though I had an understanding of, well, they have to win this battle some way, I can't think of how many times I was like, holy shit, how are they going to get out of this? Like, even this, knowing they were going to get out of it, but it was still like, holy shit, how are they going to get out of this? You know?
That's exactly my point. And I think we may even have said last week that we thought Arya would be the one to kill the Night King. I'm pretty sure I said that. But it still was a thrilling moment to me. So I don't understand what people are upset about. I truly don't.
Yeah. By the way, Bran was Bran all the way through and through.
He branded up at every turn, and I'm just glad that no one listens to him so that when he told Theon he was a good man, Theon thought it was Bran saying that. Because, like, that was the validation Theon needed, and if he knew it was coming from, like, some weird three-eyed raven thing that's not Bran, he probably would not have gotten the satisfaction he needed. But luckily, no one believes Bran when he says he's not Bran. So
we went through all of this whole thing with Bran and the Three-Eyed Raven and this arc over literally 7 seasons. And at the end of it, he worked into some ravens that flew around during the battle.
That I have to say, that might have been my
it was so Bran.
Least favorite part of the episode. But also, somehow, when that happened, I was like, oh, here we go. Bran's about to do something.
No. I also like that in that confrontation, you know, with him and the Night King in the moments before Arya arrives, the Night King is the more expression of the two of them.
Yes. Yep. The Night King, you can see the Night King is like, I'm finally, my destiny is fulfilled.
Yeah.
And Bran's like, I'm not Bran. He's just sitting there. Don't you understand I'm not Bran?
Right. But he was, well, see, here's the thing. He was powerless because he was up against the one guy who actually knew he wasn't Bran. So his, like, one thing to say.
That's true. He had nothing to say in that scenario because the Night King's like, no, bro, I know. That's why I'm here.
Yeah, I'm here because you're not Bran.
Yeah. Interesting if we're going to go broader picture on this story, and I think this is a George R. R. Martin thing, not a TV thing. It's interesting that the oppositional forces in this universe are captained on one hand by a spear throwing, dead raising badass, and on the other hand by an invalid who can't say anything except I'm not Bran.
Yeah. It's a strange world. It's a strange world that's been built. But again, entertaining world nonetheless.
Yeah, and again, that's why there's an epic story about it, is because it's a crazy, strange world. If it was a boring, normal, uninteresting world, we wouldn't need this entire series of books and television shows about it.
Yeah, and look, and I knew that we would quickly get to people's complaints about this show, but if I can just shout a few praises of it as well.
Yes.
You know, I think you really hit on something talking about the sound. Like, this was, I really hope this wins some sort of sound Emmy, this particular episode, because I just, it was so great. Like, the dialogueless scene, it was almost 10 minutes, right? Basically no dialogue to open this episode.
And similar stretches throughout. I mean, this was, it felt like 5 pages of dialogue for 85 minutes.
Yeah, what a great flex. You know what I mean? It was, in a way, it was like, I feel like this was the kind of thing that Dunkirk was trying to do. You know what I mean? Of just like, we're just going to stick a camera in the middle of the war and you're there.
That's such a great comparison. And for the life of me, I will never understand why a world of apologies, but a world of twatty critics want to celebrate Dunkirk, which has no stakes, no characters, no story whatsoever, and really is not that much more visually impressive than the next explosive, expensive flick.
Yeah.
And yet they want to lambast Game of Thrones for being too predictable when it has all of the things Dunkirk is missing, and it looks better.
Yeah, I agree. To me, I would watch this over Dunkirk 1,000 times out of 1,000.
You literally would have to pay me not just a nominal amount, but a significant amount of money to watch Dunkirk instead of this, if I had two options.
Yeah.
Like, we're getting for sure 3 digits, if not 4.
Yeah. You know, and there were really other great, like, some of those scenes in the crypt of just, like, those guys sort of listening to what's happening above, like, the sound there was really amazing.
There was one scene in the crypt where the effect it created was like a skirmish happened at the door to the crypt and then was resolved and moved away. But you didn't see any of the fighting. You just saw the faces and heard the sounds. This was exactly what it was supposed to be to me, and I mean that in the best possible way.
Mm-hmm. There were all of these scenes where you see these people who, you know, you have all these years of investment in at this point, and you don't know, like, it feels like this is maybe the last moment they're ever on screen, right? And, like, you don't really know they're alive until they pop up again. So, like, you know, you're like, oh, there's Brienne fighting, and there's this, like, palpable sense of relief. Like, we didn't kill Brienne.
Sam was knocked onto a pile of, and by the way, Sam should clearly be dead. There's no way he'd actually survive
like
that. But still, that was thrilling. Like, Sam's knocked onto a pile of dead people and fighting his way out, and then the camera swings around to a new, and it was just, it was awesome.
See, and you're right. I get what you mean about the bar, because I do now, I do have that feeling of like, okay, well, look, Sam better have a part to play in the rest of this story.
Yeah.
For you to not take that moment. You know what I mean? Like, I hope they didn't just leave him alive just to do it. You know what I mean?
Here's the thing. Here's what I would say. This is where I may prove to be wrong. But based on everything that's happened, I don't imagine a lot of the people who were left alive were left that way for fan service purposes.
Yeah.
I don't think this show believes that what its fans want is everyone surviving the fight because they like them. Like, I don't think that is what's happening here. I imagine most of those who survive do in fact have a part to play or an elaborate death scene planned for sometime in the next few episodes.
Yeah. Look, they're not taking any of these guys out without, I feel like, trying to give some sort of justice for their character. It's not going to be like so-and-so throat slash. You know what I mean? Like, even
probably
in the instances, even in, like, when you look at the Red Wedding, right? Like, you know, those people, their throats got slashed, but they still really got their moments. You know what I mean?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Catelyn Stark really got a moment there.
She kills that girl. She has a crazy moment. And even Rob kind of has a moment there.
Yeah. So I don't think everyone's going to sort of get their honor at some point.
Yeah. I just. And freaking out about who's dying now and what it means about how many people or the right people are going to die in the next 3 episodes. Like, just chill. Everybody chill.
Yep. So, I mean, look, this week seems like aftermath and strategy for the battle to come.
Well, and maybe some travel, right? Because we got to get down there.
Yeah, there'll be some travel as that goes, as that's happening. And then, the next to last episode, historically,
it's gotta be another battle, right?
Is always a fantastic, crazy set piece. And then you have the aftermath and denouement, if you will.
Yeah, the old denouement.
This feels as big as television can be right now, and yet it's going to get bigger, right? So,
I got to say, like, and I don't know if they say this every time a big show ends. I don't remember the end of The Sopranos feeling like this, but I guess we already have Game of Thrones by the time The Sopranos ended.
We did not, I don't believe.
Okay, so but I don't remember this sort of feeling at the end of The Sopranos that, like, this is the last one. We're never doing this again. Do you feel like this is even possible?
Well,
a show that had this level of popularity and pop culture centralness as it comes down the home stretch of its eighth season? I mean, this is a decade of our lives.
Yeah, I mean, look, the best analog, I guess, would be Breaking Bad, right? Because it ran about the same number of seasons and and grew in terms of cultural phenomenon as it went, where, you know, the last episode was the biggest it was ever going to be, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think Game of Thrones was on the air by the time Breaking Bad ended. In fact, I'm pretty
sure
it was.
Maybe that's what I'm thinking, yeah.
But I don't, and maybe I don't think I was into it at the level that we were, and it certainly wasn't quite, it was always big, but I don't think it was quite the cultural thing it is now. Uh-huh. I don't think that we saw, oh, well, there's this other show, Game of Thrones, and when that wraps up, it'll be like this. Like, I think at the time, that felt the last. Right?
You're right, but I'm not thinking about, like, well, I don't see the show, so it probably isn't going to happen. I'm thinking, like, the way TV works, I don't know if it's going to happen.
I think that there will be a show, that airs in a broadcast format of some kind, whether it's cable or network or whatever, and that, you know, the reruns re-air on a streaming service and it catches fire. You know what I mean? Like that Breaking Bad sort of arc.
I hear you.
That's
going to
happen
like,
again with something. You know what I mean?
Maybe. I still feel like that is only the first step to the level of pop culture ubiquity that Thrones has reached now, though.
And it could just be whatever the prequel turns out to be.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that counts. I think it has to be, I mean, not original IP per se, because that's not what Thrones is anyway, but like sort of pop culture unseen.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like Star Wars, the Disney Star Wars show is going to have a ton of eyes, but there's something different going on here, I feel like, from just a pop culture perspective.
Yeah. I want to hat tip Matt Zollersheis.
Okay.
Who writes for Vulture, New York Magazine, and a bunch of other places, including RogerEbert.com, which I think is where he did this essay. But he wrote, I thought, a really interesting essay about Game of Thrones and Avengers and the current and future business climate and like what it might mean going forward, how this is a start of a new kind of era, and what that means for cinema. And I just thought it was a lot of really, if you're interested in sort of the business and the future and content and distribution and stuff like that, I thought it was a really smart essay. Yeah.
Could you give us like a snapshot?
Yeah. I mean, basically, we're sort of entering this new era where people are kind of loyal to these sort of corporate entities that are dishing out this content, and how that's going to just sort of change the process of the way we watch and expect things. It's hard for me to sum it up exactly in terms of what his conclusions were, because a lot of what he was saying was, I'm not necessarily saying this is better or worse, it's just going to be different. You know what I mean?
All right.
But yeah, I thought it was a really interesting sort of take on all that, it's sort of easy to see, right, that TV, and this is one of his main points, that TV and the walls between like cinema and TV and all sorts of other sort of forms of media are kind of collapsing, right? That Avengers is a series of movies that really has a lot of characteristics of a TV show. And Game of Thrones is a TV show that essentially feels really cinematic, right? And these are sort of the things that are kind of taking over the world. And those walls are going to continue to fold, because essentially it's just going to be about content, and the delivery system is sort of going to be incidental. You watch it where you watch it. That ultimately a lot of these things are going to wind up be watching on phones, you know what I mean? Which is sort of, is going to have an effect on the experience. So...
I think some of that is more about the size of TVs than the transmission to phone, the ultimate transmission to phones. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't, some of it's about the size of TV, but I also think it's about people. People want the content exactly wherever they are, where they want it, and the way it's most convenient.
Of course they do, but I'm just saying, if you have like a 50-inch television, which an awful lot of people have these days.
Yeah.
Right? If you have that, and you're sitting 3 feet from it in your TV room, 5 feet from it, what are the odds you have a better look at a movie theater?
Yeah. Well, look, that's certainly true. But I also think that a lot of people are going to watch Game of Thrones on their phone, even though they also own a 50-inch TV. So what does that say? You know what I mean?
Really? You think a lot of people who could watch it on a 50-inch TV are going to watch it on a phone for the first time? I don't know about that.
Yeah, because maybe they don't, you know, maybe they have a 50-inch TV and they don't have HBO on it, or maybe this is just, it's just where they're at or what fits for them. Maybe it's the second or third time they're watching it. I don't know. You know what I mean?
Well,
but
see,
I think a lot of people are going to watch it on phones. You know what I mean?
You're right, but I think it's going to be a lot of second and third timing. I think people do still seek out at least a good big screen for the stuff that they're visually excited about.
Yeah. I turned out the lights in our house to watch this, because I just, you know, it was tricky to see. I to me, clearly a choice. I think you agreed on that as well, right?
Yes, it was a choice that I liked.
I mean, look, there were times when they blurred the screen very clearly and purposely.
Yes, they were when they were in the fog.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's an effect that they definitely did on purpose.
Yeah.
And I liked it.
Some of it was saving some money for the dragon battles a little bit, but I think it worked out great. Yeah.
The reason this wasn't an 80-minute dragon battle is because you can't afford that. The reason it was dark and blurry and hard to see it sometimes is because they wanted it to be.
Yeah. I also think an 80-minute dragon battle would have been a poor story, to be honest.
Agreed.
It would have been like watching an 80-minute car chase, essentially.
Correct.
Yeah. All right. I feel like we've hit most. Is there anything else you want to tack on to Thrones? I feel like we should mention that that's an epic 48 hours for Arya Stark. Can you do much better than that?
Yeah.
Lose your virginity and save the world in the span of less than 2 days.
Right. Now you saw. Did you happen to listen to the Bill Simmons podcast this week?
I have not yet. No.
Oh. Because he asked the question meaningfully, who had a better 48 hours, Arya or Bob Kraft on the day he was at the spa in Jupiter and then won the AFC championship game?
And the answer to that is that it's clearly Arya, because Patriot Super Bowls just count less. We've just agreed,
that wasn't even the Super Bowl.
You're right. It was AFC Championship.
AFC
Championships definitely count less.
Yeah, although I would point out, this is sort of the AFC Championship of Westeros, is it not? I mean, the opponent may have been more formidable in the AFC title game than in the Super Bowl, but they're off to play another game.
Yeah. This is like when the two best teams are in the West, you know. But you still got to go play the finals, right?
Right, exactly. This is last year's Rockets-Warriors series that just happened.
Indeed.
Now you got to go just beat Cersei 4-1.
Yes, and we'll get to Rockets-Warriors at some point in the podcast. I want to stay in the world of entertainment before we jump into sports, though, if you don't mind.
Whatever you want, bud. Yeah,
sorry.
I thought that was rhetorical. I was actually asking.
But yeah, let's talk about someone great.
Great.
What'd
you think?
This is a movie that is, you know, if it was a person, it would be batting its eyes at you. Like, it's definitely like trying to be cute and charming, but it certainly succeeds at it. You know what I mean?
Isn't that enough?
Yeah.
it took a little convincing to get you to watch this.
Yeah.
I think you thought it was something dumber than it is, because it's definitely winky and cute, but it's also well executed. And if you're trying to be winky and cute and you do a good job of it, that's a good movie.
Yeah. And it was one of those things where I think my initial reluctance was like, I thought this was going to be more what was the movie that we watched that kind of the rom-com that blew up on Netflix with Lana Perfect Condor?
Eight. Oh, the Boys I Loved Before?
Yes, yeah, All the Boys I Loved Before, which, by the way, I enjoyed. But you know what I mean? Like, I kind of thought it was that, and this is clearly much more. I mean, in my notes, I was like, this feels like the Netflix algorithm went into my life and said, all right, let's crank out a movie that we know he's going to watch.
I guess that's essentially what I would say to you is that this is To All the Boys I Loved Before, but it's for you.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, as I learned a little bit more about it, I was like, in fact, I think I texted you. I'm like, oh, it's named after an LCD sound system song. Like, of course I'm going to watch this. You know what I mean? So
right. Like, it's people my or your age in New York instead of high school people in whatever goofy town, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And the casting is such a home run, right? Like, it's just people that you enjoy, you know. I mean, we're, you know, and I would say you especially are fans of Gina Rodriguez in general.
Well, and again, it's like that's where this movie just kind of got everything right.
Yeah.
You know, that's where, like, you're like, yeah, it's great casting. And if you just think about it, okay, we've got a, you know, movie about a music writer. We need someone to be cute and endearing and also have it be kind of funny that she's a little bit of a mess and foul-mouthed and gassy. And who would be good in that sort of cute, funny role? Gina Rodriguez is like the first name you think of.
Yeah. By the way, I think she had some production credit. So I feel like she had, you know, that this was built as a vehicle for her. But I could be wrong about that.
But again, like whether she drove the car or not, it's just it makes perfect sense as a vehicle for her. And, you know. Like, again, you just sometimes just doing a good job makes a good movie. It's less complicated than a lot of things.
Yeah. but yeah. So, but like casting DeWanda Wise, who we loved as you know, in the She's Got to Have It revival as like the best friend, I thought was a really great choice. I mean, obviously, we love Lakeith Stanfield.
Yes, and the girl from Pitch Perfect was really good as well.
Yeah. You know, or like people like Alex Moffat from Saturday Night Live in supporting roles, or Jabuki White from the Young White.
Jabuki.
Yeah, it was great. You know, like, yeah, I love it.
Yeah, so like that's
RuPaul,
what this movie
for
is.
For God's sakes, you know, like RuPaul shows up at one point.
RuPaul was tremendous in this.
Yeah.
And by the way, oh no, never mind. I was going to say RuPaul is also on Broad City, but does not play a drug dealer in Broad City.
No.
Slight spoiler for someone great, but still, you're still going to love that scene. I promise.
All right. So there were definitely some.
Are you going to do Radio Guy audit of this movie right now?
Radio Guy audit? Oh, like in terms of like the music stuff?
Yeah.
No.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to be like, now there is, some misleading stuff about the life of a music journalist.
Well, look, you know, I've met a few music journalists. Some of my good friends are music journalists. I've yet to meet one that looks like Gina Rodriguez. For sure. They may be out there. I really mean that with no shade. I just have not met.
Or who lives in New York the way Gina Rodriguez seems to.
Yes, with the lifestyle that Gina Rodriguez is living. And I do feel like this needs to be mentioned. Uh-huh. Like, everyone in this movie is, like, superhumanly good at casually doing drugs.
Yes.
Like, they are on so many drugs in this movie. And, like, having these, like, deep, meaningful, well-written conversations, like, while completely high on Molly. Like,
yes. Yeah. The effect of drugs in this movie is incredibly convenient, is how I would
and,
put it.
And fleeting, I would add.
Yes. Yes. But, like, you know, I guess maybe, like, if you just do drugs really, really well, that's what your life is like.
There is a, you know, an 80s movie type montage scene of them, like, getting ready for the party.
Yes.
And it's a lot of fun. That scene is a lot of fun. But
and
if
they smoke a lot of weed.
If you were looking, and they are, like, chugging shots of tequila.
Yes.
Like.
Yeah, they do not make it out of the house if they actually consume at that rate.
And they, and then it ends, and they look amazing, and they just walk to this party.
And look, we've all had those nights where someone opens a bottle of tequila as you're getting ready to go out, and you don't go out. Yeah. So that's definitely what that was, but then they went out.
And, you know, and look, and it's a magical New York where everything is sunny, unless there's a, you know, unless for comedic reasons it needs to be not sunny, or, you know what I mean? The subway needs to be dirty when it's time to make a joke about the subway being dirty, kind of.
Exactly.
Kind of New York.
Yeah,
you know?
but again, that's what this movie is.
Yeah.
No one is asking this film to be a, you know, a critical look at the streets of New York.
Yeah, no, it's definitely has that rom-com aspirational life porn vibe about it. But it's, you know, for that, and it's just hard to make this kind of movie, I think, without some of that.
Of course.
It's really enjoyable.
You know? It's like you don't make a comic book movie without a battle and some tights.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, this is the form. This is the form, and some people may not like that form, and that's fine. But this is as pretty, I would say this is as well as you can execute what they're trying to do.
And I would say it's nice. I mean, look, it's definitely a romantic comedy, and there's romance in it, but, like, and I don't know. I guess this is probably a spoiler, so you should tune out now if you haven't watched this, and you're gonna.
Yeah.
But, like, I feel like getting the boy is kind of beside the point.
Yeah.
And that's totally. And that's nice. You know what I mean? Like, I like that about it.
Yeah, that almost might be the point, that the boy is beside the point, you know, or the relationship or what have you. It doesn't have to even be gendered, but so often, you're right, this is a movie about, even if it's in some trite way where she finds the new guy at the end, you know what I mean? That's usually how this movie goes.
Right. Did you like the way that the movie sort of unspooled this relationship, where you sort of realize that you've been lied to a little bit by the narrator, kind of as you go, if that makes sense? I don't know if lied to is strong, but you know, you realize it's something other than what you sort of picture it is. You know.
You realize she's a biased narrator.
Yeah.
And I like that tool here.
Yeah. She's essentially, I mean, you know.
But that's the nature of perception. I mean, if this show says anything, it's that, you know, our lives are a collection of our own perceptive experiences, you know?
Yeah. This is, I feel like this is one of the ways in which the movie is, like, you know, the algorithm of Netflix has been rating my devices. The song Supercut by Lorde appears in this movie pretty early on.
Yes.
I love that song. And it's one of those songs where I was like, God, somebody could, like, make a movie out of this song. You know what I mean?
Right.
And it sort of feels like that's kind of what happened. Like, the song appears, she's doing the stuff in the movie, and really the version of the relationship you see is her kind of her Supercut version.
That's exactly right.
Gradually unravels, and I know that song just from reading an interview was meaningful to the writer director of the show. So yeah, like, I do think it does sort of feel like, oh man, they really got my thoughts to make this one.
Yeah, totally.
But I'm here for it. I'm here for it, and I would definitely recommend that you watch it.
Well, and I also think, like, just based on the buzz around it, that's a feeling a lot of people had, which really is an accomplishment.
Yep.
You know, to make a lot of somewhat disparate people feel like, man, they really got me on this one.
Yep. And look, if Netflix wants to keep cranking out stories like this in various guises, you know, we felt like Friends from College was sort of like this.
Yeah. I love all this stuff.
Yeah.
This is a great, I need this content to get me from one, you know, Game of Thrones to the next sort of a thing.
Right. And this is, you know, kind of to go back to that essay I was talking about. I do think this is the kind of thing that has moved from feature films used to do this, and now I think you're going to find this on these streaming services. That's where this sort of stuff is just going to live now.
This is one of my favorite things about the streaming service model, is that we seem to once again be getting these what I would describe as normal size, but I think the movie industry sees them now as small movies. Just a normal sized movie about a life that's good. Yep. That's great. I need that in my life. I want that. I don't need everything to be epic or what have you.
Yeah. Do you think Jenny was a good writer?
Well, I mean, Rolling Stone hired her. Yeah, and I don't imagine they're doing a lot of hiring.
I didn't totally get the vibe. Like, she listened to a lot of stuff. She definitely knew about stuff.
Right.
I didn't totally get the writer vibe from her. But
yeah,
I'm okay with that.
Which is funny. She's also a writer on Jane the Virgin, and I often forget that that's where her money comes from, theoretically, and she, like, got published and stuff. So I don't know how convincing Gina Rodriguez is as a writer, but as, like, a charming lady who you want to fall in love with, she's dynamite.
Yeah, I think you just want Gina Rodriguez around, right? That's, you're going to hire her because you're like, oh, well, if I hire her, she's going to hang out here every day.
That's true. Maybe the Rolling Stone office is just in need of a good hang.
Probably is. I also think the Rolling Stone office is in New York now, but that's a story for another day.
Yeah, I think it was in. It's been in New York for a while. But, yeah. hey, whatever, man.
Exactly.
Details.
All right. I want to talk about Lizzo for a sec.
Okay. Good. Here's the upset of the week.
Yeah, I feel like this is a turning of the tables, right? Me, like, trying to turn you onto an R&B record? Yeah.
Yeah.
So was I right in that this would be exactly the kind of thing that you would really like?
I wouldn't say that, but I did like it. I think my wheelhouse is a little more...
It's not as experimental... You know what I mean? As I think a lot of the R&B that you have recommended for me.
It's not as experimental,
but
also
very
it's
straightforward, I feel like, this record.
Yeah, it's not as much R&B either. Yeah, I mean, I would say that what this record does throughout, the one thing it is consistently is like a big pop sound.
Yeah, it's fair to call it just pop. If you want to just call it pop, I think that's more than fair.
Yeah, I understand why you said R&B, though, because she definitely feels like a... chanteuse or something. I don't want to say Amy Winehouse, but more in the Amy Winehouse vein than the, you know, Christina Aguilera vein, right?
Yeah, sorry, I maybe should have said more, you know, because she definitely traffics in a lot of, like, Motown horn sample kind of, like that sort of end of R&B.
But also a couple trap beats and some like, you know, more classic R&B ballad type
yes,
of stuff. Like,
agreed.
This is an eclectic album, and it has a really big sound, and she has a really big voice, and while you're right, it's not experimental per se, it's very creative.
Yeah, I would agree. It's original, I would say.
Original.
It's original, but not experimental, if that makes
it's
sense.
It's a big pop sound, and she feels original, and I that's all good. I wouldn't say, like, it's great, or this is my favorite album of the year or anything, but, like, I'm all for it.
Yeah, fun hang, and I feel like probably a good person to go see in concert.
I bet she's awesome live. Yeah. She just, you know, not on every song, but what she does have in that voice that I do think is special is just like she has the ability that I think a lot of really great singers have. They talk about it on The Voice all the time, but, like, you just believe her.
Yeah.
And I promise it's not the lyrics. like, the lyrics are fine, but she just is a very convincing vocalist at times in a moving sort of a way.
Yeah, I agree with that. There's also a swag there, right? Like, there's just a swag that she really pulls off.
No doubt. Yeah. So I'm a fan. I feel like there's more good stuff to come from Lizzo. And I enjoyed this. And listen, there's probably four or five songs on this album that I really think are bangers that just, you know, and they're different from one another, but they have a sort of unique spirit about them, and they go hard, man.
Yeah. I was a little surprised that you had not heard of her going in.
I realized after getting in that I had, and in fact, I had heard the is it the Missy Elliott song, the tempo?
Oh yeah, yeah.
So I had heard of her. I just it didn't register when you said it for some reason.
Gotcha. Because I do think that I don't know if blowing up is quite the word that I would say, but I think she's getting noticed. You know?
Yeah. No. I mean, that Missy Elliott song was on like a new music playlist I was listening to, so she's at least getting that sort of notice.
Yeah, she had a song on her last record. I think it's called "Good as Hell." Got a ton of syncs. In fact, I think one of the presidential candidates is using it as their theme music in this election. That was kind of around and sort of, I think, was maybe the precursor to this thing is going to happen. And I feel like this record is going to be pretty commercially successful, at least from what I can tell. So
you know what it sounds like in a way? This just occurred to me. She's a little bit like if the woman from... Oh my God! No, I'm blanking on the Alabama Shakes.
Oh yeah, Brittany Howard. I want to say.
Yeah, if she made a pop album, yeah. I think this is kind of what it might sound like.
I could see that. I could see that.
That's the type of voice that it feels like Lizzo has. She applies it a little differently, but that sort of soulful, convincing, moving type of vocal.
Yeah. All right, really quick, because we got to talk Hoops, and it's time to go already. New Negroes?
Yeah. Now, were you surprised by what this was?
Yeah.
And what did you think it was going to be?
Not necessarily pleasantly. I thought it was going to be more...
Did you think it was going to be Chappelle's show?
No. Yeah. More not... Yeah. I didn't. Chappelle's show's maybe the wrong analog, but I did think it was going to kind of be more sketches with those two guys.
Or
and
like
not just
mixed media in some way,
yeah,
right?
Just here are some stand-up comics. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's almost like they did the setup for the Chappelle show and went to the Chappelle show. And I'm not specifically the Chappelle show, but that type of show.
Yeah.
And went to that set. And
Key
and
Peele might be a better analog, actually, for what I was kind of thinking. You know what I mean?
Sure. Key and Peele. Yeah. But then instead of using that set to introduce sketches and other things, they use that set to just bring out some stand-ups.
Yeah, exactly. They bring out some stand-ups, and then there's usually an open mic video at the end.
And a video, right.
Yeah.
Which, again, not unlike Chappelle's show. And open mic Eagles videos are funny, I think. I enjoy them. But I don't know that there's much here.
Yeah, I agree. I felt like 10 minutes in, I'm like, all right, I know exactly what this is. And I
feel like I'd rather... in succession, watch a Baron Vaughn stand-up special, watch a young comedian special featuring a bunch of the people on this show, and then listen to some open mic Eagle, as opposed to watch this show.
Yep. I realize as we're talking about this that we left one item from the homework off our docket, which was the Tim Robinson sketch show on Netflix, but we should talk about that next week.
Oh, should we?
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
I have seen it. Have you seen it?
Yeah, I don't think we need to push it. I'm ready to talk about it right now, and I don't need much time.
All right, well, hit me.
Don't waste your time with this hot fucking garbage. I'm so... This is the decay of humanity that people think this trash is funny. You know what's not funny? Doing something disgusting and staring at someone awkwardly. It's just not funny. I reject this at its very core. And honestly, I don't. If you liked it, I don't want to hear about it.
Okay. I would say I did not hate it nearly as much as you did. But I didn't think it was particularly good, and I was more than amused by that commentary. So I'd rather not add anymore.
It's a fucking Tim and Eric is already B shit. This is like the B version of that B shit. It's trash.
Yeah, the one thing I would say is it's like, to me, this is in the Sandler bucket. And you really like the last Sandler special. I just feel like it's just juvenile humor.
But it's not funny.
I didn't find it to be that funny. Yeah. Yeah. Lazy is a good word for it. It felt a lot of it felt lazy. to me.
Yeah.
This felt Sandler, like the Lonely Island sitting around and just coming up with stuff and throwing it at the wall. That's what it felt like.
I don't know. If Andy Samberg was really that involved in this, then I have lost a lot of respect for him.
I don't know. Just going on the credits. He does appear in one, I think, later, but I haven't seen
it. Yeah, lots of people I like appear in these, and I don't get it, man. I don't get it at all.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not great. All right, can we talk hoops a little bit?
And Seth Meyers recommending it is, like, the most confusing thing to me.
Yeah, see, now I'm not, like, I just think this was Seth Meyers is like, oh, my buddies are doing this, so I'm going to plug it on Twitter.
Like, I wonder if he watched it.
I'll put it this way. I'm not taking any more recommendations from Seth Meyers.
No. No, because I truly wonder if he watched it. So. And if he did, I would just love to get his real opinion, because there's no way he thinks that's great. It's just not great. Even if you're into that sort of trash comedy, which I just think is literally the worst thing in the entertainment world, this is not a good version of it.
All right. Well, I'm glad that I was clear that he recommended it and not me.
Yeah, I'm also glad. And you know what? I knew what it was from – I didn't even need a preview. From the literal cover image on Netflix, I knew it was going to be stinky. I believe I said that looks like something that's going to be awful.
I don't remember you saying that. I'm not saying you didn't, but I don't remember you saying that.
Or maybe, like I said, that looks like something that's going to make me angry.
Well, it did. All right.
Yeah. Success. In that respect, success.
Are you angry about this Rockets-Warriors series yet?
No. Why'd I be angry?
I don't know. Maybe it's disappointed you in some way.
It was a good segue, though. I shouldn't have shat on your segue like that.
I was really just trying to get us there.
I appreciate you.
My initial thought after game two was very much in the, you know, from the Houston point of view of this, in that, like, what I wanted to say was, I don't think you can count the Rockets out, that, you know, they've been in, really, like, the Warriors have not put any distance between them and the Rockets in any one of these games. Like, they managed to stay in them all.
Let me ask you this.
Let me just finish the point. All right. Sorry. Like, they're still a very good team. They still have the possible, if not presumptive, MVP. And you know there's going to be a game where he goes nuts that hasn't happened yet, and a game where they shoot the lights out as a team that hasn't happened yet. And so I'm like, you can't count the Rockets. But then as I thought about it more, I was like, well, wait a second. Houston has to win four out of the next five games to win this series, right? And
correct.
Golden State has won a road playoff game in, was it like 19 straight series or something like that? Like, there's a pretty good chance they're going to win one of these road games.
Yeah,
which basically means
literally every series Steve Kerr has coached in, I believe.
Yeah, which basically means that the Rockets have to be perfect outside of that. And I just don't – you're not – I just don't see how you're going to keep Kevin Durant down four games in a row. And we haven't really seen a big game from Steph or Clay in this series yet. And one of those is coming as well.
Listen – admitting that there is a non-zero chance of almost everything, this is as close to zero as it gets. Rockets are not coming back.
So you were just like, it is over.
Yes.
I'm hesitant, frankly, to say it's over, but I think it's only just because I don't want to say it. You know what I mean?
Frankly, I never thought the Rockets had much of a chance. And there's just no way they can do it from 2-0 down. I just don't believe they have any shot. I think yesterday's game was to determine whether it was a 5-game series or a 6 or 7-game series, and I think the answer is 5. I do think the Rockets get one at home just because they're a good team. You're not wrong about the stuff you said, but you made the point. They're not winning 4 out of 5.
Yeah, you got to win 4 out of 5.
You know, you have to win 4 out of 5, not just 4 out of 6, but 4 out of 5. And yeah, it's not happening. Barring injury, barring some sort of unnatural disaster, it's just not realistic.
The only thing, right? I mean, the only thing that, you know, to me leaves, you know, takes this from, 98%, I guess, where you're at, to maybe 95% or 90, you know, probability, is they did lose 4 out of 5 once, right?
Yeah, okay, but you're talking about, you know, what's James Harden going to do? Is he going to go off? Based on what he was saying after the game last night, it feels more likely he's going to go blind.
Yeah.
Like, I don't...
Look, and this is, we're giving James the benefit of the doubt when his playoff history may not necessarily...
Oh, was that not clear that I was being sarcastic?
Sorry, it was not, no.
Oh, he must have said 15 times, I couldn't see anything out there. And yet, he had the ball in his hands 80% of the time after he came back in the game. He shot constantly, and he hit the shots at about the rate he usually does. So... maybe he's always blind. Like, the guy got hit in the eye. It looked painful. I'm sure it sucked. But, like, it takes a gift to be so overdramatic that I am annoyed with you when you're actually injured.
Yeah, I mean, like, look, I guess. I...
He laid on the ground, writhing in pain, covering his face for like, a possession and a half?
I'm not saying he's not dramatic, but I will trumpet and say that there's a lot of drama on both sides. Like,
oh, no doubt. I'm not defending.
No one loves Draymond more than me, but Draymond at the press conference last night going, I love the game of basketball, and I can't believe you guys have just been talking about the refs for 2 days, that all we're talking about is the refs, when you literally run 50 feet and throw your hands in the air every time anyone calls a foul on you.
You know what?
No one's a bigger Draymond backer than me. But even I was like, come on, bro.
Yeah, I don't love that, but I'll say a couple things in his defense. First of all, he's in the heat of battle, and I think even he would admit goes a little overboard at times. He's talking about literally days and days of sustained referee talk. So I understand that perspective, even though certainly it's an ironic statement. The other thing is, I think given just relevant to this conversation should be mentioned, I thought he was remarkably composed last night.
Yeah, within the...
Agreed. He didn't do those things. He didn't run away. I mean, you could see frustration a couple of times, but to be fair, they were terrible calls that he was frustrated with.
He did pick up a tech, right? I mean, I think there's some talk they're going to rescind it, correct?
But yeah, did you watch that play?
I did not. I was at a show, so I missed some of the game.
What happened was he was boxing out on a rebound. He got shoved. He turned towards Nene after they sort of got tangled up. And Nene just started screaming in his face, and Ed Malloy gave him double tech. Yeah. Like, it could not have been less confrontational in that situation. So I just don't – and there were a number of really pretty brutal calls where, like, you could see the frustration, and he just turned and looked away.
Yeah, I do think that some of that – I guess my original point there is I do think that some of that behavior – was maybe less motivated by his opinion about, I can't believe we're talking about refs, and more by the fact that he realizes that the suspension limit is not too far from where he sits currently. So
I think it's less the suspension limit than it is just whether he came to it on his own or it's something they've talked about. Like, last night was a game where no matter what happened, the most important thing was the Warriors not getting distracted by referees.
Yeah.
So I think that's where those comments come from. I think that's where his, you know, calmer on-court demeanor comes from, is like, they made that a point of emphasis that the last 2 days the Rockets have been complaining constantly, we're the better team, we're up 1-0, no matter how bad the whistle might slant in their direction in game 2, which I didn't think it did. I thought, actually, Scott Foster really, against all odds, wrangled that thing and called a good game. I think the point of emphasis for the Warriors was, no matter what happens, if we just play basketball tonight, they can't beat us.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's true.
Understanding that the league assignments are set, that it wasn't clearly was the assigning of Foster was done before the series. It was not necessarily a reaction to game 1. Do you think it's right that he's refereeing their playoff series when there's so much history and their record? Their record in games that he refs is pretty jarring.
It is.
For a team of that quality. They have not won a Foster ref game in the Chris Paul era. That's pretty wild.
Yeah. Here's the thing about that. And look, I don't know. I can't say for certain what happened in the six. It's six games they've lost.
Six playoff games. I think it's more than that. When you look at the regular season, it's a lot more than that, I believe. So.
Yeah, but the whatever. It's a pattern, is my point.
Yeah.
And I'd have to look at those games to tell you exactly what happened, obviously. But here's what I do think is worth considering. Scott Foster, who also has made enemies of the Warriors on more than one occasion, almost exclusively through demeanor and conversation, not his calls. Like, people complain a ton about Scott Foster, but the complaints are you can't talk to the guy. He won't have a reasonable conversation.
That's the Rockets' complaint as well, right?
Yeah. That's right. The complaint is not he doesn't give us a fair shake on calls. And in fact, he's one of the highest rated referees in basketball, and that's why he gets these assignments, really. It's not about Rockets or not Rockets. It's about they only have so many guys they think are playoff level. And so those 8 or 10 guys get a ton of playoff assignments, and Foster was going to work this series. He's probably going to work every playoff series, including the finals.
Yeah, eventually it's going to work its way around to him again at some point, right?
So there's nothing really to be done about it. But I will say one thing that probably deserves consideration, given how well people respect Foster's actual ability with the whistle, and in particular, he's known as a referee who gives a good, fair whistle to visiting teams, who won't be perturbed by the crowd, a guy who doesn't mind being hated for making the right call. I think it's worth considering that what he does is call the game straight up, and the Rockets don't get one over on him as well as they do on many other referees.
Yeah.
It's not that simple, and that doesn't explain everything. But I just don't – a lot of people seem to want to refuse to acknowledge a very simple fact, which is that a significant portion of the Rockets' strategy for winning basketball games involves not just involving but fooling referees, what they do. And so I think it's reasonable to consider that part of the problem here is it's hard to fool Scott Foster.
Right. And look, you know, you can talk about – I'd have to see which playoff games they lost. You know, I can tell you one of them was Game 7 of the Western Conference Finals last year.
They missed 27 straight threes.
Right. They talked about 81 missed calls or whatever, but like when you miss 27 three-pointers in a row, come on. What can you say? Why are you saying anything other than we missed 27 three-pointers?
That's an easy answer. It's very easy to answer why that audit happened. And it has nothing to do with actually hoping for the NBA league office to change anything or to look at that game more critically, to watch the game with the audit in front of them. Like, nobody ever expected any of that to happen. This report was created for one reason only, and that is so that Daryl Morey could leak it to the media after the Rockets lost a game in this series.
Yeah,
that's it. And he wanted to make sure that he did everything he could in the aftermath of a loss to get the referees to call things the way the Rockets want them called. Because, again, it's a specific part of what they do. They want things specifically. Look, it's how they're trying to beat the game, is to have the game called in a certain way. It's part of the strategy. And so Daryl Morey knows that as well as anyone. And his contribution to that strategy is to – it's the same as Phil Jackson – sitting at a press conference.
Pat Riley did the same thing forever.
Talking about referees to the media. It's the same sort of gamesmanship. And I don't think it really worked. But, you know, Daryl Morey does everything he can. one thing you can't say is Daryl Morey's not trying everything.
Agreed. Agreed. That would be the name of his reality show, I feel like. Daryl Morey is trying everything. All right, and on that note,
watch that. Would you watch that?
I probably would. I like Daryl interviews.
I'm picturing like a combination Fear Factor, The Challenge, and Making the Band.
We should pitch this. Yeah. All right, what are we watching next week? Obviously, more Thrones.
A lot more Thrones. It's another long episode, I believe.
Yeah, I think we're mostly longer episodes from here on out. Although you've been better about being keeper of the episode.
I feel
episode
like
runtime.
Maybe the finale. One of them, you know. An hour. One of them's on the short side, yeah. As much as an hour is on the short side. I forget which one it is, though. But yeah, man, I remain incredibly excited about Game of Thrones, and I think we had some other stuff that I did not write down, so that's on you.
I also did not write it down.
See, when we have these conversations in the pre-show meeting, I don't know how to define this exactly, but it always sounds to me like you're writing it down.
Yeah, but see, that what I'm doing is the actual constructing of the show stuff, like, you know.
Right, you're like checking levels.
Yeah.
So you are distracted, you're just not distracted doing the task I was hoping that you
correct
were
correct doing. Yeah. You'd think someone would have realized this and stepped into the void by now, but no.
You know what, we're only at what, episode 165? Like, we're still working out the kinks. Still ironing things out.
All right, well, we're gonna watch some stuff next week.
Not
Tim Robinson's show for sure.
No, we didn't mention this, but you know there's this Chernobyl show coming.
Oh, yeah. Is that...
Well, that didn't sound excited.
When is that? Is that this week, though?
Yeah, it's
oh, it's no, it's week. Not. It's it's Monday. It's Monday.
It's Monday. And I... Which is interesting. HBO Mondays. Hello.
Yeah, that's going to be a thing, by the way.
Yeah. Our main plan... really was just to catch up on a lot of the big stuff, not just Game of Thrones, but also check in on Barry. I think we said we'd check in on Killing Eve and potentially on Billions.
Yeah. Are you caught up with Barry at all?
I am not caught up, totally caught up on any of those.
Okay. I was going to say a thing, but I'm
not caught up on Killing Eve.
I'll save it for next week. All right. So we're going to watch that. You want to watch Chernobyl. And then the thing that we did talk about, I forgot, but I remember now, is the Ted Bundy Netflix movie.
Yes, Zac Efron as Ted Bundy.
What I'm not remembering is exactly the name of it, but Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil, Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil and Vile is the name of the movie.
I thought that was the movie with Tom Hanks about 9/11.
I don't think so, but I don't know.
That must be incredibly close and loud or something like that.
Oh, extremely loud, incredibly close. That was what
yeah,
it was.
I was. My joke didn't totally come off there.
I did not get that at all, no.
Okay, so maybe we throw Chernobyl on there too, and we'll check in on things. And I will tell you, I am not caught up on Barry or Billions, but I am caught up on lifting legs from beds to wheelchairs like you wouldn't believe.
Yeah, oh, God. And there's a lot of stuff I am not caught up on, so... so hopefully we'll have some time to get back to where we started from, and we can take it again
big
next
binge
week.
Weekend big yeah. Weekend of binging, that's what I'm about.
Binge,
not
it
just
up
television, but food.
I am traveling and gonna be a music festival, so I don't know how the hell I'm gonna binge stuff, but we'll I don't know, plane rides, I guess it'll be plane rides, plane binging.
Binging is good for, and I mean this in the television way, is good for a nice like hungover morning after a music festival.
Oh yeah. Yeah, maybe work that in there, too.
All right. I think we're good.
Okay.
Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling. And the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.